All right, I know we want to get started here on the show, but I just got an email from my mom.
Yeah? What does it say?
Classic. It's just a list of words as alternatives for swear words, because she thinks I swear too much on the show.
She gave you a whole list of swear words.
Yeah, she's given me like one, like 11.
Alternatives.
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway, this is fucking Smartless. Let's go.
Smart.
Hi, talking.
Hi, talking.
Talking, loving, learning. Wait, let's just change the title of this thing to Talkers.
You think that's a good?
I don't think it's too late.
Talkers. and we could.
You sound a little hoarse.
Well, it's just, that is
oatmeal.
It's a think bar, looking for freebies. And this is, again, think bar. That's T-H-I-N-K with an exclamation point.
Too bad it wasn't helping with your thinking.
Yeah, I was just going to say. Yeah. And that goes down great with smart water.
That's great. This is why you're on the Talkers podcast.
I'm so happy that you do most of your thinking. You don't do most of your thinking out loud. I'm sitting here uncomfortably. I've got one of, very sweetly, the other day I tweaked my back. And so I've been kind of laid up. And all of a sudden, Jason appeared at my house. True story. And he brought me over three of those icy hot patches for me.
Aww.
I know. I didn't even ask him. He just showed up. And that's...
When was this?
2 days ago.
Was that weird? I mean, it's, you know, I do something super, super nice twice a year. Probably once a year.
It was unsolicited, and he showed up, and I was sitting there, and he just showed up, and he gave it to me. And it was
That's really nice.
I've got one on right now.
I think I may have revealed how much I love you there unintentionally.
It was very sweet.
Now I'm shy.
I know.
Maybe you can come over and bathe me then.
You know, I just want to say, so we've got a guest on here today, a guy whom...
Does somebody have a washing machine going?
They're very busy. Okay. And by the way, it's right on brand for our guest because he's a very busy guy and has been for a long time. He's a man who wears many, many different hats. He's in my view, a comedic god. He was on SNL. He worked on Conan as a writer. He created some really iconic sketches at SNL. He came back out here to California, where he's originally from Illinois, near where Sean's from.
Oh, wow.
And worked on SNL, wrote on the Ben Stiller Show, then created a show with our friend David called Mr. Show with Bob and Dave.
Oh, yes, of course.
Ladies and gentlemen,
Mr. Bob Odenkirk.
Hello.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. I love you brought us right up to it. We got it.
You got that from me moving around my kitchen.
You should have heard the names in my head I was shuffling through. Sudeikis was there for a second, and then I don't think there's a Chicago there. And then, look at you, Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah, there is, I think. Sudeikis.
Wait, does he have what a part Chicago? Of Chicago?
He did a little bit of Chicago. He did, yeah.
Well, he was in Second City. Pretty sure he's a Chicago guy.
Wait, Bob,
guy.
What?
He's from Kansas.
What part of Chicago?
Well, I went to college my first year where you're from, Sean. Uh-oh.
Which college?
I went to COD.
You did? College
For
of
one
DuPage?
Year.
I lived two blocks from
That's
there.
That's our cue, Will. Let's take a tight five, you and me, Will.
Well, I was 16 when I went to college.
No way.
That's not surprising.
So I was kind of afraid of going away to college. I felt like I was so young. I would really not.
Well, did we grow up near each other then if you went to College of DuPage?
Like, yeah, I went to Naperville. I grew up in Naperville.
That's insane. I grew up in Glen Ellen.
You know what? That's so funny because when Jason was 16, he dropped out of eighth grade. So that's like this very similar
son of a
story.
Yeah, now, so 16, you went to college at 16. That means you're one of those not dumb guys.
No,
right?
No,
you and Keith
it doesn't
Olbermann.
Mean anything. It doesn't mean a damn thing, except that I found out I could leave high school and they'd let me go. And wow. I was like, all right.
So then in 10th grade, they said, you're done.
I just went to school young when I was a little kid. And then I left a year early. So I cut 2 years off.
But was that normal in your family? You have like six siblings, right?
Seven kids. So six, siblings. And
Any drunks?
My dad.
Yeah, same.
My dad covered the whole, he did it for all of us. He said, but the last thing he said before he died was, I drank all the booze. I'm so sorry, kids. I drank it all. Now there's none left for you.
So wait, so getting back, so in 11th grade, they said you need not go to 12th grade?
All my friends were a year older than me in high school, all my close friends, and they were all leaving. And I thought, well, I don't want to be here if they're leaving. So I asked, I went to the office, I said, can I leave? And they looked at my number of credits and they said, yeah, you can.
Wow.
And after, Jason, just so you know, since then I've heard that my high school has raised the, they turned up the credit number so that that's not going to happen so easily.
And all these ninth graders leaving
school. Sounds like quite a process.
Did you have to go to junior college for a couple of years to get into the kind of university you wanted?
No, I went to COD, which is a small community college where Sean grew up. Which is only a 20-minute drive from where I lived, because I could have gone to any college. No, I mean I got my degree from high school, and I just didn't feel like I'd fit in at all.
And then in college, what did you leave with? What did you major in?
I went to three different colleges and four colleges. The fourth one was just a class I took. Anyway, look.
No, I want to know what you graduated with.
I sound like a hero,
you know, but,
and a genius, a real Einstein.
He's trying to hide how highbrow the major was. Is it archaeological theories?
No. I got a major in broadcasting.
Oh.
Nice. Broadcasting.
And a minor in philosophy.
Because you wanted to be an on-air guy?
I wanted to be an intellectual, on-air, chatty guy.
And here we are on the dumbest podcast ever made.
I honestly, Jason, yes.
Smash cut to smartless.
And I'm going to lower the bar on this podcast, which is quite
good luck.
Something.
Good luck.
Well, you've been successfully hiding your sophisticated, intellectual highbrowness for years. Not to imply that you've been coming across as a dumbass, but you certainly seem very approachable anytime I've ever talked to you.
Wait. So Bob, take us back for a second. So you go to college, you go to four colleges because you had to show everybody up. And then when was the moment? So when did you start getting into comedy, performing and comedy writing and working with Smigel and Conan and all that? What was that?
Honestly, I started writing comedy like diligently, like as part of my daily routine when I was like 10.
Wow.
I just loved it. Wow. I just loved sketch comedy.
Like knock, knock jokes? What's a 10-year-old writing look like?
No. Sketch, fake commercials, parody commercials.
Yeah.
That would be the first thing.
Were you a big Saturday Night Live fan at that age?
I always liked Saturday Night Live. I was a big Monty Python fan.
Yeah, same.
Right.
And I particularly liked the Saturday Night Live episodes that Steve Martin hosted in the early years.
For sure.
Those were another cut above everything else on the show, which was a great show. And its first 5 years, a great, great show. But Steve Martin hosting was like supercharged. But I loved Monty Python. In fact, when I interviewed with Lorne,
Lorne Michaels from Saturday Night Live, yeah.
When I did get an interview with Lorne to be a writer at SNL, I don't know, I was sitting out there, you know, he makes you sit. He makes you wait for hours.
Like 1 a.m. appointment, right?
And, you know, like Janine Garofalo famously waited 6 hours to go in for her meeting. Mine was not that bad. It was like an hour.
I'm
not
still
so
waiting.
But
nothing gets me more nervous than waiting for a meeting. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
And he asked me, what do I like? What shows do I like? And I'm like, Monty Python. He's like, do you like what we're doing here? And I'm like, not so much. I thought he wouldn't want to get his ass kissed. I really thought, not only do I genuinely like Monty Python more than this show, I thought he doesn't want to hear me go, oh, I wish I could work here. You're so great. This is the best thing
ever.
That's
all he wants to hear, right?
That's all he wants to hear. So I go in and I'm a real standoffish, which I can be, right?
Yep.
I'm good
Sorry.
At it.
Yes.
Yeah. And I really kind of sort of purposefully was like, I'm not going to kiss this guy's ass. He doesn't want to hear that. He wants to hear that I have some perspective on what they're doing here and comedy. And I also knew Lorne liked Monty Python a lot too. So I was like, look, Monty Python was the best and still to me is the best, not this show. And you do your little show. Meanwhile, I'm a waiter at Ed DeBevick's. I'm a fucking waiter. And I'm sitting with Lorne Michaels going, nah, it's not so good. It's not so good what you do here.
But you got hired.
How did you get that interview, Bob? Like, where did that come from?
Smigel. Robert Smigel was a really important writer at Saturday Night Live almost from the time he got hired. He was just built to write for that show. So and he great. Just wrote so many great sketches. There's that great Star Trek Trekkie sketch with Shatner where he says, get a life to these people. It's such a great moment. But so many. I mean, the thing is, Robert's known for Triumph the Insult comic dog. And the number of wonderful, amazing sketches that just made that show relevant and important and worthwhile that he wrote is hard to express. And it's not just the recurring ones. I mean, he wrote, Mr. Short-Term Memory and all these and the Bears guys and all that stuff. But he wrote just the greatest thing. So he was really important there. And Lorne knew that. And Robert and I had been roommates and he had seen me in a show in Chicago and liked it. And thought I was really a good performer and funny writer. And so we had begun writing a sketch show when he got hired at Saturday Night Live. So he sort of was a pipeline for me. I was writing my material and he would share it with other writers in the office. And I would also work with him on the phone and punch up his sketches for the week. I actually got a sketch on when I wasn't writing there before I got hired there. Called Sideshow of the Stars. You remember Circus of the Stars?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Jason, were you ever asked to do that?
I proudly turned it down one year.
Wow.
Yeah, I think I was upset with the skill I was offered. I wanted trapeze, and I think I got dog tamer.
It's so great, Bob. You're one of a number of guests who have come on and mentioned these great celebrity shows that were on in the 80s, and they always go, Jason, were you on that? There's always a good chance that he was.
I know you guys had Paul McCartney on because I listened to that because he's so great. That was such a great episode. Anyone who's listening to this episode and hasn't listened to that, stop right now.
Thank you for the plug. What's wrong Thank you that? For the plug of our old episodes. We appreciate it.
Such a great episode.
Yeah.
Jason, are you invited to be on the Wings ABC special?
No. The what?
Gotta watch. This is the worst thing McCartney ever did. And I'm a huge fan. God
See,
bless.
I immediately went to the TV show
to
Wings.
The sitcom,
no,
yeah.
His band Wings, they thought, I forget the logic of this. I was reading about McCartney and I read about this thing where he did a 1-hour special for ABC for network primetime. And it was just so bad.
Back in the 80s?
Bad.
I love watching that scene.
Yeah, with Wings.
Oh boy. It would do great today.
Yeah.
Bob Odenkirk, you're in one of the biggest shows in the history of television, Breaking Bad. I mean,
yeah, I'm a small
and
part.
And Better Call Saul, right?
Let's make that connection to how you get to Breaking Bad, because I love this. Bob, your trajectory is one of my favorite of all time, and I'm very fond of you, and you and I have a long history. Bob and I made two movies together.
Great
movies.
Well,
I'm a big fan of you, Will Arnett. I think you're one of the great actors.
One of the greats.
It still hasn't had a chance to show everything you can do on screen. And I apologize for not helping you do that.
No, Bob.
You did great with those movies. Those two movies, listener, as soon as you're done running through the Paul McCartney episode, you need to watch both Let's Go to Prison and Brother Solomon. You did a great job directing those movies, despite Will Arnett being in those. You shot around Will so beautifully.
So my experience with Bob was I didn't know him. Bob came on Arrested Development in the first season, one of the first episodes, Jason, you remember, and did those awesome scenes with David where he played the marriage counselor, and then Bob and David ended up taking over each other's roles, and it was fucking insane. And I was so, I was such a huge Mr. I knew David a little bit, but I was such a huge Mr. Show fan. It really, to me, was just the pinnacle of sketch comedy.
Yeah.
And I loved it so much. Oh, God.
So
I could just
anybody in comedy, that's that is the
show. It's just it for me. And
that's so nice. Thanks,
and you
buddy.
Came. I remember one time we went to, before we did Let's Go to Prison, and we went to we were at somebody's house, a Christmas party or something. And you ended up talking to me, and I was like, man, I can't believe I'm talking to Bob Odenkirk. I just, and then you were like, here's where I think that you could, and you like gave me some advice, like on, and I really listened to every word. It was great. You'd had a couple because your dad had left a couple beers out before he passed.
A couple shots.
They were warm.
It was like a treasure hunt.
But it was so awesome. And then not long after that, they, Let's Go to Prison came together, and I got to go and work with you, and really you, me, and Dax spent so much time in that, first of all, in that prison in Joliet, Illinois.
Which is a prison. My dad drove us by that prison when I was a kid. He drove
Keep drinking,
me and
you're
my,
gonna be in here.
No, he said, he said, look over there, boys. We drove right by that two-lane highway that runs beside the prison. He goes, that's Joliet Correctional Facility. If you do bad things, you're going to end up in there. And it's a scary prison. Very frightening.
It's fucking scary as shit. In fact, Melissa McCarthy was on. She grew up nearby there, too. And she said that when she drove by with her mom in her Catholic school dress, her mom would say, like, don't let them see you.
She would always... So frightening.
Right, so scary. So we go and we make that movie, and you had... just had, you'd done Mr. Show to great acclaim. You also were on Larry Sanders, one of the other great influential comedies of all time, to great acclaim. Yeah. Then you start directing, and then...
Poorly.
Let's go to prison.
I did my best.
Both those movies are so damn good.
Yeah.
Oh. You never know why shit, and Bob and I, we had it...
Yeah,
we,
that's really true. I think it's true, Will. I mean, you don't know how these things are going to come out. I mean, there's so many components... And that goes for everything, but certainly a feature film. And you just got to hope that it all marries up and somehow is as good as what you hoped it would be, or maybe better.
I've thought about this a lot with Brother Solomon. I felt a lot, certain amount of guilt because I love Will so much as
Will
well.
Will Forte.
And he wrote that for us to do. And we went and did this movie. And I always, as you know, it was one of the funniest scripts I've ever read to date.
Yep. Yep.
And it just incredible. And I always felt like, fuck, man, I wish it was better for Will because I loved him so much.
Well, I actually had this horrible brain fart that comes to you after you fail miserably, maybe sometimes days later, or in this case, like a year later. And I thought, I wonder how that script would be if you shot it as a low budget movie on location, not building the sets. Yeah. Because it's already such a heightened, there's such heightened characters. And that was what I think really threw me off. You know, I first got that script, I read it. They asked me if I wanted to direct it. And I thought, it's too much of a meta movie. It's too, everything's too conceptualized in these people and how they look at life. I don't, it's almost like a cartoon or like, anyway, I said, I just don't know how to make this work. And I handed it back. And then I got a call like a week later, Will Arnett wants to be in it, and come on, Forte will be in it, and we'll all get together. It'll be so much fun, and it's such a fun script. Come on, and directing is fun. It's really fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'm like, ah, shit. Yeah, okay, I'll do it. But I just didn't, I hadn't figured out. Look, when you, it's weird to say this, because we just acknowledge that movies are such a... uncertain enterprise.
They're crap shit.
You can never really know for sure. But I would say that in that case, I didn't have that core principle to build around. And so I was going off what I read. And when you read it, it can read kind of like a version of Dumb and Dumber, which is to say they went with, you know, these bold, broad characters. And it would have been neat to take that same sensibility and those characters, but land it in a really low budget, like lo-fi world. It might have worked. I think it might have worked great. And you could have done it, and Forte could have done it. Same cast.
Yeah, I think that you're probably right. And I think that you and Will and I should get together and remake it. It would be the fucking hilarious thing to do.
I'd watch
the
that.
Funniest thing
I'd
to do if
that.
We did it the way we want to.
Man,
but I will say this, a real testament to Bob was years later, I think we all felt a little shitty about it because it didn't turn out the way we wanted to. And I ran into Bob, and Bob went out of his way to come over and say, hey, man, I'm really sorry. You said that I felt like I let you down, and I kind of said the same thing. And we kind of, not that we needed to make up, but we did. And I thought it really, I don't know, man, you don't get a lot of that in this thing that we all do. And you were
I'm always surprised when I go into people's offices and they have movie posters for things that were just terrible. You're like, you don't be proud of that.
Well, because it's so hard to get stuff made. People are so excited to actually got something made.
But I wanted to say to you that I've always really appreciated that when you did that, it really meant a lot to me. I think that you're a really fucking cool and big and cool person. So just that's that. And we can move on.
We get support from Canva. When your work, presentations, and docs look good, you look good. And you can design stunning work presentations, docs, whiteboards, and videos with Canva. Canva is an easy-to-use online design platform. It helps people design compelling visual content and is great for designing any type of presentation and great for any teammate. So our team at Smartless is using Canva when they're coming up with different design concepts for various things with related to Smartless and Smartless Media, because we have a lot of stuff going on. It's a busy crew, okay? And if it wasn't for Canva, they'd all be fired. Supercharge your work with AI-powered Canva presentations, docs, videos, and more. In just a few seconds, you can generate slides and text from a prompt. AI is built into Canva right where you work, so you can stay on task without any app switching. It's AI that's easy to learn and even easier to use. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva is perfect for any work task. Sales decks, hiring docs, marketing brainstorms, employee videos, you name it. Anyone at work can design with Canva. Start designing today at canva.com, designed for work. We get support from Happy Egg. I love starting my morning off with farm fresh eggs full of flavor. At Happy Egg, all of their hens roam on 8 or more acres of land, leaving no mystery to why their eggs are the best. These hens are raised on 8+ acres. I got to keep it down, because if my hens find out, they don't have 8+ acres. My hens only have like 3/4 of an acre. And they're going to go on strike. Anyway, all of their hens are cared for by small family farmers and live their best hen lives day in and day out. All of this results in eggs with plump orange yolks that are full of flavor. I just, as I mentioned, I like to kick off my morning with farm fresh eggs. The difference is so glaring between an egg from Happy Egg and an egg that just came from clearly some kind of like sad factory. And you just have to taste it for yourself. If you're a fan of eggs, which I am, do yourself this favor and try Happy Egg eggs. You will not be disappointed. You will notice the difference immediately. Get with the Happy Eggs. They're so good. Next time you're at the store, look for the yellow carton. Choose happy with Happy Egg. Visit happyegg.com/smartless to find a store near you. And if you come by the house, don't mention it to my aunts. Thank you to one of our new sponsors, My Mochi Ice Cream, for supporting the show. I just discovered cookies and cream. My Mochi Ice Cream. And I'm a little obsessed, but I'm a lot obsessed. Do you not know what My Mochi Ice Cream is? Picture this. It's a perfect little scoop of rich, creamy, premium ice cream wrapped in the softest, sweetest dough known to mankind. My Mochi Ice Cream is sweet. It's chewy. It's cool. It's creamy all at the same time. It comes in tons of fabulous flavors like strawberry, mango, cookies and cream, and double chocolate. That cookies and cream, I've always been a cookies and cream fan, but then when I had the My Mochi, oh my gosh, I mean, I was like, my mouthy loved it. First of all, an absolute knockout. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned mochis that are gluten-free, and about 90 calories each. You can find My Mochi at Target or go to mymochi.com to find your nearest grocery store. Discover the cool, creamy joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream today.
Wait, I gotta tell my Sean Hayes story.
Yeah, here we go.
This is a great one. Now, Sean, have I ever told you this one?
I don't know.
Have I ever told you that I was invited to do a part on Will and Grace?
Okay.
You don't remember this because it only lasted one morning.
Did you do a table read?
I did not do the table read.
Okay.
Okay, so tell me if I got this right. So I had little kids at home.
Were they yours?
And I was writing a movie with David Cross and all my friends, Mr. Show movie, and I was having a great time, but I was also exhausted, you know, when you have little babies.
Run, Ronnie, Run.
Yeah, it was Run, Ronnie, Run, sketch movie. We were writing a bunch of attempts, and so I was really enjoying that, but also exhausted, all the time exhausted. Little baby at home, first kid. And so they said, yeah, they want you to do Will and Grace, and it's great, you know, great show, and okay, cool, and I get up, I'm doing my normal morning. I'm taking my son. We would go on a spider walk in the morning where he'd sit in my arm, the crook of my arm, and we'd walk around the house and look for spider webs. And he'd go, dit, 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 when he saw a spider web. And we'd just walk around the house every morning.
That with Will sometimes.
Yeah. And he doesn't go, dit, dit, dit.
Yeah.
I'm so surprised you can carry me.
And then I'm halfway through my little spider walk, and I think I have to be on Will and Grace, like right now.
Oh, shit. Oh, my God. You mean you just didn't show up?
No, I finished the walk quickly.
Finished the walk.
I grabbed clothes. I was wearing my pajamas.
Sure.
Got in my car, drove to the studio, changed in the bathroom, parked my car, changed in the bathroom, hadn't shaved, hadn't showered, ran in late.
So far, you're describing Jason like to a T.
I was going to say.
Did the reading, like a reading, and then went to do the thing, and I was so not there. I was so not there.
So it was like a table read, like a...
No, like the morning read, you know.
I guess like you read it, we read it in a group, and then we immediately went to the set to try to, you know, put it on its feet.
I do remember that.
And I was terrible, and I'm thinking, I'm terrible, and I don't know, I forgot.
This is like 20 years ago.
Yes. My 22-year-old son, who was on my arm, just walked through this room.
Spider check.
Looking for spiders?
Still looking for spiders.
He is.
He's like, I got one.
He's an arachnologist now.
That's crazy. Well, I'm sorry that it didn't work out.
That afternoon, I'm at the writer's office. My agent calls. I'm sitting with David Cross and Scott Aukerman and all these guys. And I pick it up and they go, hey, Bob, we got to talk to you. And I go, what? They're letting me go? And he goes, well, it's about Will and Grace. I go, they don't want me. And he goes, they didn't feel like it worked out. I go, okay.
You're like, I didn't either.
Gotta go.
No, well, gosh, I'm sorry that happened. And
no, don't be sorry. It was my fault completely. I just didn't prioritize acting at the time. I
don't think it adds up, but there's a connection. Sean, remember that story you were talking about, the guy you had fired off Will and Grace just to prove that you had the power to fire somebody? Didn't you have a story about that?
Said it was about 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Let's move on.
You know, I really just didn't prioritize acting at all. I acting was something that I like. I did a little of it in college. I did a play when I first moved to Chicago called Line by Israel Horowitz, kind of a famous play because Pacino, I guess, did it for a long time in. And it ran for like 15 years.
Al Pacino, actor from The Godfather.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't something, you know, I was so thankful I could work as a writer.
You stopped. You wanted to write more. And then you directed these movies. You made Let's Go to Prison. We made Brother Solomon. And you were talking at that time that this is what you wanted to do. You wanted to focus more on directing and writing.
I love directing. Yeah.
But then your life takes a change. And all of a sudden, acting becomes not just part of it, becomes the main focus. And the last 10, 12 years, you have become an incredibly...
A good enough
celebrated. No, fuck that, man.
Now, are you finding that a lot of opportunity is coming your way, maybe through like sort of like a sexy indifference, or are you really pointing towards acting and not really looking at writing and directing as much?
Oh, I'm writing a lot. I'm writing a lot, but not directing. You know what? Listen, when I walked away from, actually, it was a small indie movie I made called Melvin Goes to Dinner that in a way was the most successful film I made because it made people happy. It played very well at some film festivals and won the Audience Award at South by Southwest. And that was a great screening, a great experience for me. But, you know, I walked away from those movies, Will, and I thought the first job of a director is to pick a story that you really, really want to tell, that you that just you have a strong sense of how it should be told, because you take the hit when it doesn't work. I mean, you feel it. You fucked that up. You are the core reason why that didn't work. So I thought, okay, your first job is picking a story that you just have to tell and that you know you may be wrong, but you have a strong sense of how it should be told. And I would say with Melvin Goes to Dinner, it was a play that I saw and I thought, wow, this is a fun play. The dialogue is what matters. And it's kind of really great, got this great energy to it. And we'll keep this cast together and we'll shoot it with five cameras and everyone can keep their kind of very lively interactions and energy can be sustained and brought to the screen this way. And that was true. And then Let's Go to Prison had this gritty, tough underbelly to it. And I thought, we'll shoot it like a 70s B movie. We'll do these snap zooms and we'll get some 16 millimeter film. And I had some strong visual sense of what it should be. And that was pretty good. It has some integrity to it. And then Brother Solomon, I was just, it was like I was a jobber. I was just trying to bring that script alive, you know. And later when I saw Last Man on Earth, Forte's series, I thought those guys really figured out a kind of a way to do Forte's writing that I've enjoyed very much. Yeah, I love that show.
Wait, can I go back for a second? Melvin Goes to Dinner. Are you saying you used the cast from the play in the movie?
Yes.
Okay.
Cast from the play.
God bless you, because I love you for that. I think that is amazing, because so you go see these plays, I won't name which ones, that turn into these huge movies, that you're like, well, they just nailed it on stage. Why wouldn't you just use those actors? I'm probably talking myself out of a future job, but why don't you just use those actors? They're so fantastic. So good on you. I think that's amazing.
Well, thanks for saying that. You know, speaking of a great actor who was in a play and is now getting some attention, a guy I knew in Chicago named Paul Racy is in Sound of Metal.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And he's so great.
Is that the sequel to the Julie Andrews?
It is.
Is it?
Jason, it is.
Wow, that sounds interesting. Hey,
Trent Reznor wrote the music.
When you are not putting 14-hour days under your belt on Better Call Saul, do you like to completely do nothing in the entertainment industry? And if so, what is that?
No, I never do nothing. I'm always writing. David Cross and I and my brother Bill are writing a kind of a big, sprawling comic documentary epic right now that we hope somebody will want. And I'm working on so many projects, a drama about OxyContin and a comedy. I wrote an animated show with Dino Stamatopoulos where the devil moves into a town in Indianapolis, near Indianapolis. And I'm always writing. I have a memoir coming out next year too. And I wrote a book with my daughter, you know, during this COVID time.
No weird, creepy hobbies aside from spider hunting?
No, I work out a lot now because I made this action movie called Nobody.
Dude.
I saw the trailer. It looks amazing. Hey,
Bob, I wanted to ask you about that. It's so fucking great.
What's it called again?
It's called Nobody.
Nobody.
Is that
right?
Two words?
Yeah, it looks great.
One word.
Well, I was just thinking because he worked out, you know, and
oh, Nobody.
Thanks.
Sure. Problem, dude. Yeah.
You know, puns.
Listen, you start the audience with a laugh.
They're coming back.
Yeah.
They're coming back along with parades.
Consider me ready.
Jason's memoir is coming out next year too. It's called My Life in Puns. So Bob, the fucking trailer for this movie, all of a sudden, like you have a line where you're on a bus and you're faced up against these tough guys. And you go, I'm going to fuck you up. When I'm like, fuck, yes.
And Will, that was, you know, that was a monologue. That was like a page and a half long monologue that Derek Kolstad wrote, who wrote the John Wick films. And he's a great writer. And he writes these mythic worlds and bad guys from that's come out of the shadows. And they're parts of big organizations that I can't tell you what they mean yet, but you'll find out. And that's, it's just, he's so great, this guy. I love hanging out with him. I love hearing his stories. But he had written this long monologue, and it was like, the universe has a hell of a way of paying back what's owed and all this stuff. And I'm putting it off. You know, we're working with the story, and he was really great talking to me about it because it kind of sprang from my own idea, the whole movie, because I had a couple home break-ins here in L.A. that left me with a lot of conflicted feelings.
What kind of neighborhood are you in, Bob?
Well, it's obviously
not. You get a deal on the house?
I don't have that Netflix money.
Well, it sounds like you got a real deal on this place. Is it near a prison?
it comes with meth addicts. That was.
So nobody came out of your own sort of feeling about a guy who's going to fight back a little bit?
It came out of a lot of ideas and thoughts I had, but one of them was the genuine feeling of like we'd had two break-ins, but one was particularly traumatic for my family, and I didn't do anything.
Like recent, or?
It would have been 10 years ago, that one.
And you were home when it happened?
We were all home.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
God.
And it was very traumatic.
Oh, thank God you're okay.
So I tried to keep things cool, you know? Not that I have any weapons. I mean, like any dad, I grabbed a baseball bat.
Sure.
And I haven't swung a bat since I was, 14. So, you know, it leaves you feeling like, gosh, I mean, what else could I have done? And what should I have done? And how should I be prepared? And, but if I had done something, what would have happened then? You know, and you really, I mean, it is smart to keep things cool and back off and get the hell out of there.
Everyone's okay. Yeah.
There's a residual.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry about that.
For sure. So all that sits with you. And so you just can't help but feel those feelings and ask those questions.
And it stays with you, obviously. You probably think about it at least a few times a week.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And you think about guns, you know, which I'm like definitely for stronger gun laws. But you think about what value are they? I mean, how would you have one safely in your home and then be able to use it? All these complicated issues. But most of all, there's that personal frustration and anger. And I thought I'd like to work that out and see if there was a place for that in a story. And of course, there is in action movies. That's exactly what it's built out. They're built out of. And so I proposed this. I actually thought I'd get laughed out of the room, you know. But people were like, no. Actually, it also came from my brother-in-law. He was in China, and he took a picture of his TV screen, which had an ad for Better Call Saul. And I thought, shit, if they're watching me in China, and I know they show plays in Russia and Italy and all around the world, what could I make that would play around the world? Well, an action movie plays because we know what everybody wants on screen without understanding the language.
Right.
And so there were so many things that drove me to ask, what about an action movie? I'm willing to do the training. And people said, that could work.
So did you have to train because there's a lot of physical activity, like you do a lot of ass
I mean,
kicking?
Listen, Jason, I do all of my own fighting in this movie.
Good Lord.
Wow.
I trained for 2 years.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
I pull muscles getting out of bed. Did you have?
Well, I mean, the first goal of the training was that I don't get hurt when I do the fight.
Was that successful?
It was pretty successful. What happens is you train sort of just the basics for a year and a half.
Whoa.
While this whole project was being put together, you know, takes years always. So I had a long time, but I was training for a long time. And then you put the pieces up in the gym. And you choreograph them and you learn the choreography over and over. But then when you get on set, things change. And of course, the set is maybe dimension wise, it can be a little different than what you trained in. And of course, now everything is real. The walls are walls. They're not cardboard boxes. And so you end up hitting. I only got hurt a little by hitting my fists on metal bars and stuff that were in that bus fight. The bus fight is really something.
The bus fight is insane. By the way, I didn't want to interrupt. I don't know if you ever heard the story about Jason cut his finger taking his golf clubs out of his Tesla, but
yeah, it was painful.
We thought about having a sequence where I take golf clubs out of a Tesla, and we talked about we couldn't get the insurance.
Right, right.
Just unbelievable.
Have seen the rehearsal for that.
You also probably heard the story about Jason had to bring a icy hot patch for my tender back the other day over to my house.
But you know, Jason, I love your attitude about it because another actor whose name I won't mention, I met him at one of these things we used to do before a pandemic destroyed social interaction in the world. And I go, yeah, I'm training. I've been training for a year and a half. And he looks at me and he goes, why? They have stuntmen who will do that for you. He was mystified. And I think you are too. You're like, don't you know you're in show business, Bob? You don't actually have to do anything.
I just
say the lines.
I just know at my age, 52, you pull a little thing in your back or something. Okay, yeah. Just little tweaks. They last weeks.
Yeah. You're right.
You're in good shape. I give you shit, but you take
care
of yourself.
The thing is, if you've never wrecked your knees or your back, then you can get in shape enough to do these things.
I had knee surgery 4 years ago, and I tweaked my back, but I'm never giving up. I don't give a shit. I mean, this fucking chassis was made to fucking run.
Yeah, look at you.
But wait, so Bob, how fucking crazy is that? And you had like a real bona fide from top to bottom action people involved in this, from the writing to the other producers. I know Dave Leach a little bit, who was involved with the film too.
Yeah, David Leach.
He's
a
fucking cool guy.
And trained at 8711, his gym. And Daniel Bernhardt, the best stunt actor in the world. Daniel Bernhardt trained me for that whole time. And I don't know why he did, but he was willing to do it.
Bob, you know, Will mentioned this at the top of the interview that, you know, you just work constantly. You wear so many hats. Where does that come from in the drive? And I asked that a lot of our guests, but I think it's fascinating because you look at all the stuff that you accomplished. It's like, wow, and you have this family. It's like, how do you fit it all in?
Let me finish my thought from earlier, which was about directing.
Yeah, stop cutting him off, Sean.
So sorry.
Which was just this, you know, I'm not sure I'll ever find a story that I think I like and can commit to enough to want to direct again. As much as I love directing, I think directing is probably the most rewarding thing any of us can do if we get to do it. You get to use all your talents as a storyteller, and it's just the best. It's really rewarding. But if I'm too much of a bird brain, hopping from stick to stick, and I can't focus long enough or really care deeply enough about a story, I probably shouldn't direct. And I so far haven't done it, and I'm not really chasing it.
It'll find you.
But yeah,
it'll
find you. You can't rule it out, Bob.
Yeah. But you know, the thing is, I you know, I don't really have hobbies. I read books and
you love work.
I like what I do. I like doing what I do. I like thinking about stories and how to make them work.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, I don't want to be a dilettante.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I don't want to be George Plimpton, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, which is one of the reasons why, you know, I did train for this movie and I wanted to do my own fighting. And thanks to the team at 8711 and the people who got me there, I was able to do that. And you can see that I do it. And I did it, I think, well enough. People will decide. They may tell me I'm wrong.
What do you think about, like, when you see Tom Cruise hanging from an airplane? Like, I look at that and go, God, I wish I had the sack to do that. I mean, was that something that you would do?
Well, that's different from doing the fighting. That's just taking a big risk.
Right, but I mean, as far as the efforts made for authenticity and doing your own stuff.
I mean,
stuff
I got to say, you know, I'll take that guy on.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
There we go.
You heard it here first, guys. It's fucking on.
Hey, SmartLess listener, we get support from Viator. You know, Scotty and I took a vacation many years ago. We geeked out because we liked the movie Amadeus, and we went to Austria. And it was fantastic. We went to all Mozart's kind of hangout places. And I know, total nerdville. But it was pretty cool. And I absolutely loved it. It will always be one of our favorite memories of vacationing. So maybe one of the most perfect experiences we've ever had traveling. And so next time you're looking to plan the perfect trip like that, an experience, check out Viator. Viator is a tool you can use to plan and book travel experiences around the world. Their app and website make it easy to explore 300,000 plus travel experiences so you can discover what's out there no matter where you are traveling or what you are interested in. Feel better about your travel decisions by checking out real traveler reviews to get the inside scoop from others who have already checked out the experiences. Viator offers 24/7 customer service, so you know you'll get support at any hour if things aren't going as planned. Plus, free cancellation to help you plan for the unexpected. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. From visionary filmmaker Luca Guadagnino comes Challenger, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. Zendaya stars as Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy turned coach who has taken her husband Art and transformed him into a world-famous Grand Slam champion. To jolt him out of his recent losing streak, she makes him play a challenger event close to the lowest level of the pro tournament. Her strategy takes a turn when he finds himself standing across the net from his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend, Patrick. Past and present collide and tensions run high. Tashi must ask herself, what will it cost to win? See Challengers only in theaters April 26th. Get tickets now at ChallengersMovie.com.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure. I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/smartlist to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/smartless. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
Hello, I'm Johnny Knoxville.
And I'm Elna Baker, and we have a new podcast. It's called Pretty Sure I Can Fly.
Yep, we've teamed up with my friends and bar mates from Smartless to create a podcast where we talk to folks who have more balls in a bowling alley.
People who accomplish something extraordinary despite people telling them that it couldn't or shouldn't be done.
You'll hear stories about the Air Force doctor who buckled into a 600-mile-per-hour rocket sled and became the fastest man on the planet.
And a man who wrestles alligators and sharks for fun.
Do not do this.
You'll hear about a foul-mouthed moonshiner.
Got a 2-inch dick and a 6-inch tongue and knows how to use both of them.
And an even more foul-mouthed female stunt pilot. We got bull riders.
Balloonists.
Bobsledders.
And big wave surfers. People who lay their balls on an anvil and hand the other fella the hammer.
Okay. I bet you've actually done that, Johnny.
Maybe for sweeps. Follow Pretty Sure I Can Fly on the Wondery app.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can listen to Pretty Sure I Can Fly early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Bob, I want to go back and say, because, you know, it's the thing we kind of glossed over, but, of course, you have a, and you just mentioned you're working with him again with your brother as well, but you have a long, long friendship and working relationship with somebody who I love very much. I know Jason loves very much. And Sean, I think you know. And,
yeah,
and,
I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, and he's just a guy that, big part of my life, big part of my professional life, certainly, and just an awesome guy, David Cross. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with David and what a fucking huge impact you guys had on comedy?
Well, that's nice. Thanks. I hope we helped some people and made a lot of people laugh. But I mean, people always give Mr. Show credit for this, like the way it was constructed. And I'm like, yeah, but it was really funny. That's what was good about it.
Yeah.
Who gives a shit?
But I think that that's sort of a nod to the sort of people appreciating that you guys did something that was complicated and you didn't need to. Right, like you made a bunch of people laugh on one frequency, but then you guys kept writing all these other frequencies that were much more challenging, tough to see. Just the thread, right? Just that basic concept of the thread between each guy, what might go right over a lot of people's heads that are fully satisfied with that show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's really admirable.
You know, this is a weird thing, and that show was the best thing I could do with my life, as far as I'm concerned. And that goes for looking back on it. And I'm thankful for Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul and all this stuff. But that show, as far as I'm concerned, defines me and my sensibility. And I don't know if I could do anything more me than that show in this lifetime. So it's a weird thing to have done that, feel good about it, feel like you did enough of it, you know, like that it was substantial, and then just be like, oh, I guess whatever I do next, I don't know, whatever's most interesting, but that's, it's never going to be as fully me as that.
And how fortunate that the first big high profile thing that you do as a performer is accurately portraying your brand of comedy. In other words, you didn't have to do a series of jobs afterwards to sort of reset a more accurate description and representation of what you would like to do and how you would like to be identified in the comedy world. Like, it was right on brand with the kind of funny you'd like to give. And then you just kind of took that and ran with it. Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. A lot of people don't get that.
Yeah. A lot of people never get it. Not once. And so it's funny because I'm writing this memoir and it's mostly about Mr. Show.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Both you and David held on to that really difficult kind of subversive, you know, street cred punk rock type of comedy that.
And in the same way that Monty Python kind of did. It's interesting that that's one of your inspirations, because Jason, finish your thought a little bit. It's like, you know, I grew up in the same way. I revered Monty Python. I watched every single episode and it was amazing. But that you created this thing called Mr. Show that now has the kind of same kind of impact on the comedy world that did for that generation. I really think that you've accomplished that. You and David.
Yeah, well, that's nice to hear. I've had people say similar things, but obviously Python influenced such a huge generation and also was able to get more absurdist than we got. We don't think that way. But I love that show and I even love its absurdisms. But although the season without Cleese is my least favorite season. Yeah.
Where did Benny Hill sit for you in the English sort of absurdist comedy world?
Behind the toilet.
Yeah.
No, I did laugh at Benny Hill a bit, but I actually was, Benny Hill, it's not the most egregious example of a certain kind of comedy that we all shared in the 70s that really irked me on a deep level. It really unsettled me. I think as a kid growing up in a house with an alcoholic father, and it took a while for us to find out what was going on. You know, I was probably about 12 or 13 when I understood what the thing was that made our house weird and wrong and fucked up and kind of really deeply unsettling. Like, I think this thing's going to break apart tomorrow morning at any moment.
Exactly the same feeling.
And that comedy of the 70s, and my dad loved Hee Haw, which is so crazy because later my manager was Bernie Brillstein, who helped make Hee Haw, which I hated so much. I hated it so much. Anyway, this comedy of the 70s, I think everyone was so, I don't know, I'll psychoanalyze the whole nation. You know, Vietnam was so brutal and left so many raw nerves, right? And so this comedy came in of, oh God, John Denver, George Burns, both wonderful people, I'm sure. And I got to meet George Burns. I loved meeting him. But there was this grotesque, super sweet, you know, fake, phony, everything's okay.
Yeah.
We're just joking around up here. I just hated so much.
Yeah.
And of course, SNL was a breath of fresh air. It was dangerous. It was a little more confrontational. It didn't apologize, you know? I mean, that whole thing with the Dean Martin roast, which I laughed at, absolutely. But also, there was just this side to that whole thing that was like crude comment, kind of almost maybe slightly racist comment. And then like, we're all just friends. We love each other. It's all, life is sweet. And it just felt awful to me.
Sort of lowest common denominator humor, if you will.
People were trying to come together, I think, in a really strange and artificial way. They were trying to get the nation back together or something, or could soothe their nerves after this horrific 10 years of Vietnam and bloodshed. So this hippie-ish, you know, like it was trying to bring the hippie culture into mainstream culture. Remember the Pinto car that had Levi's seats?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Remember that?
Yeah.
Remember That's Incredible? And
yes. Love that show.
Sarah Purcell. And
John Davidson and Fran Tarkin.
What was the one Fred Willard was on?
Real People?
Real People.
Real People.
Yes. People.
That's, you know, it was like this attempt by the whole country to like calm down. It's okay. We're just quirky. We're not dangerous. We don't have strong feelings. We're just quirky. We're just a bunch of quirky people. And quirky's okay. And part of me, you know, I mean, a big part of me as a kid is like, it's no, we're not just quirky people. We're different. And there's something really bad happened. Somebody say it. You know, and
I see that. Anyway. I see the connection you're making. And I think that probably informed a lot of like kind of what you did and what you guys ended up doing on Mr. Show and sort of hitting.
I think the best comedy does that.
Yeah.
You know, Eric Idle in his book talks about seeing the fringe, the beyond the fringe guys, you know, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore and I forget the other two, also great writers. And he said, seeing it as like in college, this was comedy with anger in it. And I agree. I agree that comedy should be a little bit unsettling, really great comedy. It should be a little serious about itself.
It's got to be, there has to be, like you just said, there's an element of danger and there needs to be an element of surprise. Anybody who's ever, for me personally, made me laugh, they always say something that's really, they surprise you in a way that you, in just by definition, that you weren't expecting. And I remember McKay, Adam McKay once saying, describing somebody who I won't mention, who's very famous, and saying, yeah, he's not, I was like, that guy bugs me. And he says, yeah, because he's got zero surprise to him. And I was like, yes. That's exactly it. And by the way, street cred, we used to call when we, the first season of Unarrested, anytime we would like go to do something, and you know, David would go, Cross would go like, oh man, that's lame, blah, blah, blah. And Jason and I would go, hey, street cred, what should we do that's cool? Like we'd always say that and be like, fuck you guys.
He kept us on our toes.
Arrested Development is a great example of a show that, you know, I consider that a height of comedy and it doesn't apologize or hold your hand. I mean, you really have to pay attention.
Oh, and even for us making it, I mean, we constantly had to ask Mitch Hurwitz for, you know, comedic interpretation on all these incredibly smart things he was writing. I mean, everything existed on multiple levels that you'd need 14 layers of parentheticals to try to understand. It was very tough for me. I still don't get a lot of it.
Yeah, I love that. So if you were asking about David, David and I are a really great marriage of failure and
and a lot of success,
falling short. But we entertain each other. We make each other laugh and we kind of compensate for each other. And the weird thing is in different ways. I mean, he probably is funnier than me. But there are times when I'm bringing the jokes and he's bringing the structure. And we just really hand it off back and forth between inspiration and jokes and creativity and structure and sort of focus and grounding the piece. And we just keep balancing that out between ourselves. And it's hard to, I actually don't like thinking about it too much,
which is
a good sign of like something that's kind of magical. you don't want to think about it. It's like if you're married for a long time, you just go,
I was just going to say that you can make the analogy to a good marriage where you identify, well, we don't need two Bob Odenkirks. We got one great one. And so you don't want to marry another Bob. You want to marry somebody who's a proper counterbalance or pleasant opposite to who you are. And you kind of give them, going back to Will's point, her lane and you stay in your lane. You know, David can make certain people laugh and you can make other people laugh. And that little combo, that cocktail just works so beautifully.
And also, that you don't need to break it down. You don't need to understand why it works. It just does. And you can kind of move on. And
David makes me laugh.
Same.
I think more than any other person. I mean, Zach Galifianakis, is super funny all the time.
Incredible.
And I think Tim Heidecker is one of the funniest people I know. But David's just like, just so funny all the time. He likes pranking more than I do. I'm not big into pranking people. That's a big part of what David loves. It's a surprise. It's to do something that sets up the audience or whatever that audience is. I mean, if you're in an elevator with David, he'll start saying something that will disturb the people around you. And it's a private, and I put the word in quotes, joke, because how is it funny? They didn't do anything. They didn't ask for a show.
Uh-huh.
But he loves that stuff. Even in this thing we're talking about right now, he keeps talking about sort of misleads. And it's like, all right, well, I mean, we'll do a few of them. But he loves that shit. He just wants, well, you got to have David on.
I know.
We can't make his deal. We just can't make his deal.
Believe me.
You guys, I honestly say it was nice of you to want me to do this because you are all more famous than I am.
Yeah.
And you are.
We like to talk to people that we're huge, huge fans of and try to make us a little bit smarter.
We love you. And I've always looked up to you. And thanks for coming and doing this, man. You're just such a huge talent. And I'm so excited for you that you have so many different chapters and you keep fucking doing whatever you want to do. I think it's thanks. So rad. Fucking rad.
Please direct another movie. Yes. Please.
Please.
Yeah. See. That's nice of you. Thanks.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Bob, for doing this.
Thanks for having me, guys.
We love you.
Bye.
See ya. You too.
You know what? I didn't mention to Bob, but I wanted to, when I first got my production office for my production company, I'm one of three actors in town with a production company. Yeah. And he worked one level below me, on the floor below me. And he just walked up the stairs one day, he knocked on the door, he goes, "Hey, I'm doing this animated series. Can you come down
keep
and do a
down?
Voice really quick?"
Oh, I thought he was going to ask you to just keep it down because he's recording up there. And the clogs that you were wearing at work were not working well for him.
Right. No, he just said, "Can you come down and do a voice? It'd be so fun." I was like, yeah. I was like, Bob Odenkirk just asked me to do a voice. That was so awesome. He was so kind. And I don't remember the name of the show. It was like, the characters' names were in the title of the show, but I don't remember the name of the show, but it was great.
It was Will and Grace Animated.
I'm sorry, do you want us to guess? Yeah, are we supposed to guess?
Yeah, guess. Go ahead. It'd be a fun game.
Will, how'd you make Bob Odenkirk's deal on that?
So I just yeah, I mean, as you know.
You guys have to do another movie together. Things happen in threes. You got two.
That's a great idea to remake Brothers.
We should do it, right? We should call Forte.
That's so rad.
At one point, we made so little money the opening weekend. Like, I think it was like $545,000 opening weekend. It was a complete bust. It was on like 8 screens or something. But and I went to Tom Werner, the producer, and I said, "What if we remade it and the budget was what it made opening weekend?" And he's like, "Great, go for it. I'll sign that check today." but that was like, you know, 10 years ago. But I have thought, like, it'd be really funny to get – that script was so good. It was me and Forte and Kristen Wiig and Shy McBride, and there are lots of people that are haters in it. So many people are in it. And it was a really fun – the script is brilliant. Forte's writing is just brilliant. And the movie's pretty good, but it could have been, as Bob said, we wanted it to be something else, and it wasn't. And it was just one of those things.
I think he was far too self-deprecating to say that, you know, that it was all his fault or that any failure of any movie is a director's fault. There's so many other things, not to bore the audience to death, but, you know, the marketing and the date, you know, the studio, the other films that are out there, you know, is there a storm on the East Coast? I mean, it's so many things. You guys did great jobs with both those movies.
Yeah, I think, it was one of those things where I think a lot of us involved in it had regret about the way it turned out because the script was so good. And Bob, kind of out of the blue, coming up to me and sort of making an amends, if you will, almost, really was, I think it took a lot, you know, showed he's a big person and was able to do that with no ego and just kind of go, "Hey, for my part, I'm sorry." And I was like, "Yep, same here." And I thought it was really awesome and a very cool, again, you don't get a lot of that, obviously, in this business. You know, a lot of people are happy to spread the blame elsewhere.
Yeah, he seems like such a decent guy.
He is. He's a really decent guy. So anyway, I'm so excited to have him on and have always been and remain such a huge fan. And then to go from, to start as a writer, you know, he and Conan wrote together and with Smigel and, you know, to write on SNL, to write on Conan, to then writing on the Ben Stiller Show, to Mr. Show, to Larry Sanders, direct a bunch, and then do Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, and now has this action movie. It's like,
yeah. It's a great career.
There are no limits. You know, I joked with you, you know, about his lane. I mean, here's a guy who's like, I have no lane. My lane is whatever the fuck I feel like doing in the moment. And for me, that's inspiring.
Yeah.
Do what takes you in the moment, you know? And
even if you want to look for spiders, great. Fill the morning. Be late for work.
Fill the morning.
I know. Phil, he spent the whole morning looking for spiders and then forgot to kind of show up a little bit.
Forgot to get
it's hilarious.
Forgot to show up at Will and Grace.
And then the phone rings. I love just the phone rings and he goes, it's Will and Grace, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you've been fired before, you know that feeling. Always known when I'm about to get fired and I get a call from Principato, and he'd go, well, you were right. And I'm like, yeah. They're letting me go, right?
It's happened to me a couple times.
Sean, have you been fired?
Bye.
Oh, you didn't want to answer that? I'm sorry. Sorry. One more time. What were you saying?
He's trying to buy out of here. I'll buy.
You can barely commit to it,
but bye. Smart.
If you like SmartLess, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Back in the 90s, Pepsi and Coca-Cola were in a heated race to try and win loyal customers by any means necessary. But when Pepsi launched an ambitious promotion that encouraged people to buy Pepsi and redeem points for prizes, they overlooked their own fine print in a major way. I'm Misha Brown, and I'm the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Every week, guests join me to chronicle one of the biggest pop culture fails of all time. Like, who at Pepsi thought it would be a good idea to advertise that people could earn enough points to redeem a military jet as a prize? They never imagined somebody might actually try to snag it. But a 23-year-old did, and suddenly, Pepsi owed him a jet. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.